Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Growing up, growing old, growing deaf, growing limb, growing love of a musical genius. That's the sum of Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, coming to HBO Wednesday night. A very personal subject for the special's maker, producer, director, co-ed, and award winner, Irene Taylor-Brodsky. She joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Where is TV headed this next decade? Well, my second guest this afternoon has some answers. Next half hour, we'll listen to Al Lieberman, the popular media professor of New York University's Stern School of Business. Also ahead, a Golden Globes TV recap, Succession Creator's New Deal, our new project trivia question, and Big Bird's Heart and Soul Completes Life. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker, and present on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, tomorrow will be televised, brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. For a great holiday gift, get a 3 free books when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Great to have you with us on this Monday afternoon for the program All About Television. 52 degrees top of the hour here in New York. Raining on and off today, expected to tomorrow, maybe a little bit of Wednesday as well, but it does clear up in time for the weekend. We're good to have you with us, got some wonderful guests for you over the next hour or so, and we invite you, as always, to be interactive with us. All it takes, ring the phone and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. If you're not into the phone, we have a chat room for you. Great way to get your thoughts across with us. It's SimonApple04 by name, and you can find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen or speaker screen too. Follow the instructions, and other people can be live with you. Award winner Irene Taylor-Brodsky is live with us here in New York after these news notes. Jesse Armstrong has more than 2020 Golden Globe nominations to cheer about this afternoon. The Succession creator has a new 3-year private development contract with HBO. Armstrong will continue as Successor's showrunner, with Season 3 arriving on HBO next year. Here's another HBO development. New Space Center comedy series Avenue C will blast off January 19th. Hugh Laurie leads the cast of this program from Veep creator Armando Iannucci. Look for NBC Universal parent company Comcast to spend about $2 billion on Peacock's first 2 years of existence. The mega-performing venture will debut next April through smart TV sets and connected devices. NBS supported off the bat. Comcast chief financial officer Mike Cavanaugh told attendees at UBS's annual global media conference here in New York this morning that Peacock will break even during 2025. The New York-based conference, stands press attendance for the second year in a row, continues to Wednesday afternoon. And the 6th episode Cheerleader Unscripted presentation is in production at Netflix. Cheer will cover Navarro College's squad from Corsicana, Texas. Last Chance U overseer Greg Whiteley is the producer-director. Well, more news notes featuring the recap of the full Golden Globe television nominees list later in the program. But right now joining me here in New York is Oscar nominee, Emmy winner, and Peabody winning producer-director and editor Irene Taylor-Brodsky. Irene, welcome into the program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This is the second time that you have done a special dealing with your family and dealing with how they deal with being or growing deaf. What does it take to make such a personal statement and capture it for television?
Well, this answer may surprise you, but when you make a film about your family, I think you have to be ruthless. And what I mean by ruthless is you have to be ruthless in your percent, in your pursuit of honesty and your pursuit of having the camera rolling even in the hardest moments. I don't mean moments where people are getting ashamed or humiliated, but moments that are hard for any of us to talk through, walk through, live through, and even more to film them while we're living them. So I think that really the hardest part of this and the part that took the most grit was just reminding myself that I needed to shoot now and I could always edit something out or choose to leave it out later.
The first time you did a special covering your family here. That's H-E-R Now. That's the show that won the Peabody Award some time back.
Here and Now.
With Here and Now. I believe dealt with your parents and how they dealt with deafness, and also dealing with the fact that your son, Jonas, was able through a cochlear implant to turn his deafness into hearing. How soon after that did you decide, I'm going to revisit this subject and further the conversation?
I definitely never thought I would make another family film after I made Here and Now back in 2007. This was really more something that fell from the cosmos, you could say. By that I mean I finished that family film in 2007 about my deaf mother and father. And then that year, I actually gave birth to my first child, and I found out he was going deaf. So once that started happening, again, the instinct was not to make a film right away. But as he grew up and as he developed a love for music, and then he developed a love for a very particular piece of music called the Moonlight Sonata, and then I learned that Beethoven wrote that piece as he was going deaf, I realized I had this truly cosmic coincidence on my hands. And as a storyteller, I really thought it could be beautiful scaffolding for talking about the evolution of the deaf experience in the world we live in. Beethoven lived deaf in the 19th century. My parents lived deaf in the 20th century. And now my son is a 21st century deaf kid. And there's just been so many changes, and I think it can really give us a chance. It's a dialogue starter about what does it mean to be disabled these days. You know, it's definitely an evolving concept.
How did your son develop a love of Beethoven?
Well, his paternal grandfather is a musician and a Baroque instrument maker. He makes harpsichords. He builds them. And so he is very much playing music all the time in front of my kids. And Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata was something that he learned when he was 13 years old, and he's always been playing it as long as I've known him, and he played it around my kids all the time. So it was a melody that I think had special significance to my oldest son, Jonas. And as he developed the ability to hear with cochlear implants, it was a tune, it was a composition, it was a melody that he grew attached to. And once he developed enough skill with the piano, he decided he wanted to learn how to play it.
The film we're talking about is Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. It's an HBO special, and it premieres this Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time. We have got the award-winning producer, director, and co-editor with us live this afternoon and tomorrow. Televised, Irene Terebrowski, joining me here in New York. Glad you're with us as well on Blog Talk Radio and Speaker. Simon Appleton with you for the ride. If you have a question or comment for Irene, make the call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Next Monday on our program, we'll feature the award-winning documentary series 30 for 30 on ESPN. We'll have one of the producers of one of its newest episodes, Theo Anthony, with us. He'll be our lead guest. The program is called Subject to Review. It's all about how instant replay transformed the face of tennis. Theo Anthony from ESPN's 30 for 30 will be our lead guest. And then we'll highlight some of the best shows and worst shows of 2019, and look at 2020 with one of my favorite guests, Mr. Plumbing Insider himself, who just started, by the way, in a brand new role we'll talk about as well, and that is Mark Bretman, who's now with the brand new website, Next TV, from the creators of broadcasting, cable, and multi-channel news. Irene, just the whole idea of your son and his growing love for Beethoven, who, by the way, next year we all mark the 250th birthday of that great composer, would be story enough. How did the other elements of the story, particularly Jonas's relationship to his grandparents, how did that all come together?
Jonas has always had a significant relationship with his grandparents because they're the only deaf ones in the family. So he is someone who I think can look at them and maybe see a bit of himself. and they can look at him and feel a certain affinity for his experience. I think they also, like many grandparents, try to pass on some of their value system to him. And for deaf people, you know, there is a very certain value system around communicating. Some deaf people sign, some people read lips and speak. Everyone kind of has their own way. Well, in our family, we use all of the above. We use all the tools possible. So we have cochlear implant technology. We have the use of sign language. We use lip reading and speaking. Everyone's voice sounds different. My parents have a voice that not everyone understands, and my son Jonas has a voice that you would not know that he had any kind of communication disability at all by the sound of his voice. So, but, you know, most of the people in our family can hear, and we all have a very close relationship to the deafness. It's not that you have to be deaf to be able to connect with the deaf people in the family, but I think they definitely have a very close affinity for that experience.
When you were researching this, especially about Beethoven's life, what surprised you that you didn't know before?
You know, I think when I started making this film a couple years ago, I fell into this narrative trap that most of us fall into when we think of disabled people who have accomplished so much. We have this sort of hero narrative of like the mad genius or the hero who overcame their disability or overcame their shortcomings in order to produce greatness, right? We have many people in our world, in art, in music, who fit that bill, right? And I think that I always thought that Beethoven made the music he did in spite of the fact he was deaf. But the more I listened to Beethoven and the more I really listened to what he created after the deafness began, and by the time he was completely deaf, and the more I watched my own deaf son become a better musician, not in spite of his deafness, but because he was deaf and because he was experiencing music in a way most of us never experience it, I've really come to realize that Beethoven did not make the music he did in spite of the fact that he was deaf or going deaf. He made the music he did. He disrupted the rules of classical music. He created some of the most recreated pieces in the world of music today because he was deaf and because he brought his deafness to his music.
Mm-hmm. One of the themes in this special is transition. It's not just, for example, your son dealing with love of music. It's also about his grandparents and how they are dealing with not only the world of no sound, but also the world of growing old, the world of growing mature.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, in this special, handle transition and that theme from beginning to end?
Yeah. You know, everyone in this film is going through some kind of metamorphosis, or maybe more to the point, it's a coming of age. You said it when you introed this piece, that it's about a deaf boy growing up and a deaf man growing old, and the world's most famous deaf person growing into himself as a newfound deaf musician. So everyone's kind of growing up in a way. My father is growing and grappling with the challenges of getting old. He's developing dementia. He's losing some basic skills that he's had his whole life, and he's reflecting on what it meant to be a deaf person his whole life. My young son is growing up literally. He's going from 10 years old to 11 years old in the film, but he's learning how to use his deafness to his advantage. For example, he gets very frustrated as the film goes on because he doesn't like listening to his own mistakes, and he cannot stand how much his brothers and his family members are interrupting his playing. But then he watches his grandfather take off his implant every day. He can turn it off, and he learns, well, wait a minute. I have this superpower. I don't have to listen to things every second of every day. I can turn off my implant, so I can be deaf if I want to be deaf. So he started playing piano and playing the Moonlight Sonata as a deaf person, not as a person who could hear. And lo and behold, he stopped hearing his mistakes, and he stopped letting things bother him because he couldn't hear his brothers yelling at him. Beethoven, likewise, he basically went through this suicidal depression. He decided that his deafness was a horribly isolating affliction, as he called it. But if you read his letters, he said, my art and music will save me. I love music so much that the music is going to prevent me from taking my own life, and I am going to find a way to let my new experience as a deaf person make me a better musician. And lo and behold, the music he went on to make after the Moonlight Sonata is really the music that's arguably his most famous, his Fifth Symphony, his Ninth Symphony. His Ninth Symphony he created when he was completely deaf. And as the lore has it, he was basically presenting this symphony at its debut, and he got a standing ovation, and he had to be turned around to face the audience because he had no idea they were even clapping.
When did you start the cameras rolling on this special, and how long were they rolling for?
The cameras were rolling for about a year and a half. I filmed Jonas learning the Moonlight Sonata for 6 or 7 months, but the film actually covers 80 years of family archives. So there's footage of my mother from 80 years ago, shot in color back in 1939. There's also footage of Jonas with an iPhone taken just a couple of months before we took the film to Sundance. So it's really a very long storyline, but the bulk of our filming we did over about 1 to 1.5 years.
Mm-hmm. By the way, we have somebody in our chat room, so if you would like to get involved in our conversation, either put your thoughts in the room or give us a call, 646-652-2906. Sooner you do, sooner we get to you. Was there a turning point? By the way, with other work you've done as a filmmaker, how do you apply it to this particular special? Things you've learned, or was there something new you learned that, in fact, out of doing this special, that you can apply, let's say, to what you'll do in the future?
Well, let me first tell you that films I've done in the past that aren't around, that aren't about my family have taught me the most about how to make this film about my family, and that is that excellence is excellence. Ethics are ethics. Standards are standards, and you should have them whether you're filming your family, whether you're filming people you don't know, whether you're filming people whom are doing things that are untoward and maybe not honorable. You still have to treat everyone with the same amount of respect and professionalism. And so I think that there were ways in which I maintained some formality, even with my own family. Now, moving forward, I will tell you that one of the things I'm constantly reminded is that you don't have to love your subject, literally your subject matter, like your character. You don't have to love that subject in order to tell something that is truthful and that is honest. So I think that in moving forward with my next projects, I will always remember the value of trust, and that whenever you embark on making a film with someone, you know, I'm a documentary filmmaker. I don't pay my subjects as actors. I don't have a script. I don't hand them a piece of paper and say, read from this, do what I tell you. I film whatever they do. That becomes my story fodder. That becomes the building blocks of my story. So I don't control them, right? But I do have to treat them in a way that allows them to be truthful and allows them to be honest and allows them to be vulnerable. And sometimes what that means is saying, please be comfortable with my camera, and please understand that if you say something or something happens while my camera is rolling and you're not comfortable with it, we can turn the camera off and we can talk about it. But don't censor yourself before anything comes out of your mouth. I'd rather someone try to be themselves, and then we talk about if something went awry or something came out that they're not comfortable with. Because we're all human. We all say things that we regret, or we all act in a way that's embarrassing. You know, and this has happened to me time and time again. And I think the key thing is you almost need to have a covenant between director and subject matter when you make a nonfiction film, because there really has to be a basic foundation of trust and respect. Like I said, you don't have to think that the person is doing something honorable, but you do have to think that that person is worthy of respect and worthy of everyone's respect. So even though, you know, I haven't done many investigative documentaries. I have done some, but, you know, we say in legal terrain and in our court system that someone should be innocent until proven guilty. And that is definitely my approach, that everyone is interesting and honorable until the evidence overwhelmingly proves otherwise, right? So I really try to take that fresh approach with everybody. And likewise, when you're working with your family, that's probably your biggest blind spot, is that you love these people in the film so much. You forget that maybe other people may not love them. And it's not that they won't like them. It's just that they won't think they're as interesting as you think they might be. So I think that another thing you have to do as a director when you're making a film that's so personal is you have to prove the worthiness of your characters. You need to prove that these people are worthy of your time sitting down for 90 minutes in your seat. There's a lot of movies out there to choose from. And I'm not just going to say, well, I love them, so you should love them too. I'm going to prove to you why they're interesting, you know? And that's, I think, you know, why it's a taller order in a way when you're making a film about people you know.
You're hearing Irene Taylor Brodsky. She has won an Oscar nomination, an Emmy win, and a Peabody win for her work. And her latest work is on HBO this Wednesday night, Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. She joins me here in New York this half hour on Tomorrow Be Told Live. Simon Apple, one with you live from New York. Thank you for being with us on this Monday afternoon for the program All About Television. And if you have a question or comment for Irene, get it in now at 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Irene, when I first heard about your work, one of the things that came to mind was Barbara Koppel's breakthrough documentary, Harlan County, USA, which was on Turner Classic Movies on the Essentials a few weeks ago. And one reason why is because this is her first work, by the way. And she not only produced and directed the film, she edited it. She was very into the music track. She even did the camera work. And it seems that you borrow a lot of what she did into what you do. Is that a fair assessment or fair comparison?
Well, I respect Barbara so much, and if anything, her work has been a model for me. There's a tenderness, I think, that Barbara feels for her subject matter that is always evident. I mean, she's a professional. She followed the basic professional tenets of, I think, nonfiction journalism when she was making that film. Indeed, that is why it is in the toolkit of every film student in America who wants to make documentaries, Harlan County, USA, right? We watch it in film school. But I think there's a tenderness that Barbara feels towards her subjects that really I would aspire to when I am making my own. And I think that tenderness comes from a fundamental respect she has for individuals and people who are not just underdogs, but are going through a hardship. And so I would love to think that some of my work in the past has modeled some of the basic rules she's established for so many of us in the field.
We had on this program, Irene, when she did a terrific documentary for Lifetime called Running from Crazy, dealing with Mario Helling's family and how their relationship with mental illness. In fact, she won an Emmy nomination for that special as Best Nonfiction Special of the Year. And she's an amazing woman. And she's still out there doing documentaries. Two more things before I let you go. One is, what do you think about how television is portraying people who are deaf or people who are blind? For example, in scripted television, we've had the groundbreaking series Switch at Birth, which was on at the time on Freeform, ABC Family, when you were doing your first special, your first documentary dealing with your family. And it seems that more and more there's an interest level in having deaf people and hard of hearing people be involved in television, both as series creators and as people starring in their own programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some great questions. What do you think about that?
About deaf people starring in their own programs, you mean?
Yeah. Inside their own programs or being more involved in front of the camera as well as behind the camera.
Yeah, well, I think it's critical that we get people of all abilities in front of the camera and behind the camera. I will tell you, I have a nonprofit organization called the Treehouse Project, and one of the things we are very focused on is elevating cinema literacy amongst deaf people and deaf artists, because too often deaf people and people with vision impairment don't have access to some of the best cinema out there. They may be seeing the blockbusters, they may be able to see things on streaming services, but if they want to go to a film festival and see the latest cutting-edge stylistic material or the latest community screening film that's going around into a community, they often don't have access to that because these things are not captioned or they are not described with audio, so-called audio description for deaf or for blind people. So I think it's very important that as we talk about getting more deaf people representing both the acting field, subjects of film projects, and also directors and creative people, we have to remember that we also need to be elevating the level of literacy at the same time, because only people who are literate in filmmaking can actually contribute to good filmmaking, right? They can make good films if they know what a good film looks like and what a good film feels like, right?
Yeah, including a good TV show like This Close, the Sundance Now series, now in its second season, which is produced and starring a deaf couple who incidentally was on our program 2 years ago, and that was a pilot shown at, guess where, Sundance Film Festival. What's coming up for you? What's next for you, Irene?
Yeah, I'm developing a couple of different films. I will just say I'll have to be a little coy on this, but my next film, my main subjects probably will not be speaking. So I will be looking for all sorts of cinematic tools to build a sense of character and a sense of emotion with that. But these are the kinds of challenges I like to take on. I like to approach my subject matter from a very spherical, multi-sensory perspective, and this particular film, Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements, it may sound like it's about deafness, but it's about a whole lot more than that.
Absolutely. Like I said, it's about growing up, growing old, growing deaf, and growing a love for a musical genius who marks his 250th birthday next year. Moonlight Sonata, Deafness in Three Movements. You can catch it this Wednesday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Pacific Time on HBO, and also later this month on HBO Now, HBO Go, HBO On Demand, and other streaming platforms as well. If you want more details, and by the way, check your local links where HBO is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the program online, go to HBO.com. That's HBO.com. And people, Irene, want more details about the Treehouse Project. Where can they go online for that information?
Treehouse, we are just developing an online presence, so at this point, not just yet, but stay tuned. If everyone goes to the film's website, moonlightsonatadoc.com, that'll be the best way to keep finding out more about the advocacy work we're doing, because Treehouse Project is principally working on getting Moonlight Sonata out into the world fully accessible. But as we move into next year, we're focusing on true accessibility for all filmmaking platforms and with different filmmakers besides this particular film.
Irene Tabobrovsky, thank you very, very much for joining us this half hour. It has been an absolute treat and a wonderful joy to have you on. Good luck with this special on HBO Wednesday night. I hope a lot of people see it. Gotten very good advance reviews. Who knows, it could be an Emmy or Peabody Award winner this time next year. And to you and your family, all the very best for a wonderful holiday season and a superb new year and decade ahead.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Irene. Take care. Enjoy.
Okay, bye-bye.
Irene Tabobrovsky, producer and director and editor of Moonlight Sonata, Deafening Movements, coming to HBO this Wednesday night and joining me here in New York this half hour on Tamavi Televised. More of our program all about television. First, some fine words for folks at Audible.com. Are you still looking for a holiday gift for Christmas, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, for you or someone you love? Hey, how about the gift of sound, the gift of hearing, the gift of getting the world in a whole different way? I'm talking about a trial run for Audible.com. It's the leading provider of spoken entertainment information, and definitely it has what it takes to transform the way you hear the world. And you can hear some of the best audiobooks around through Audible.com, including a terrific new book that's out there called The Bitter Roots by C.J. Box. It's a very unusual police tale with a little bit of the unique West along with it. And that could be one of your books you pick. Remember, Audible has over 108,000 titles to choose from. You listen to them on any device, whatever you're hearing us on right now, at Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and iHeartRadio. Just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. That's audibletrial.com/televised. And you get free audiobooks, including two from the growing catalog of Audible Originals. That's original radio productions or audio productions, best of Broadway, off-Broadway, and regional theater, and also great one-woman and one-man shows. And guess what? You also get a one-month trial to check out all those audiobooks for yourself or for someone you love. And great customer service, too, from the fine folks at Audible's parent, Amazon.com. So hear for yourself today why Audible.com can transform the way you hear the world, and it makes a wonderful holiday gift that lasts a lifetime. AudibleTrial.com/televised. Just dynamite, and I promise you it will be a very, very special gift for yourself or someone you love this coming year and decade ahead. And speaking of this coming year and decade ahead, coming next, one of my favorite people to talk to about the world of television will address those questions. He's Al Lieberman, the popular media professor at New York University Stern School of Business and the co-founder of the annual Future of TV Forum event here in the Big Apple. Also, we'll have a recap of the Golden Globe TV nominations that came out this morning. The awards take place next month on NBC. And also a very special Kennedy Center honors tribute to the late Big Bird's voice and soul, Carol Spinney. That's all coming up after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. And our classic trivia question, too, by the way. You're listening to www.blogtalkradio and www.spreaker.com. More than 35 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out Cybersecurity News, the latest on that field, Saturdays, 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. That's 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific for Cybersecurity News right here every week on Blog Talk Radio and Spreaker. And remember, that's BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to an extended second half of Tomorrow Be Televised for this Monday afternoon, the 9th of December 2019. Simon Appleman with you live from New York. Happy to have you aboard. If you have questions or comments for our next guest, make the call 646-652-2906 or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. And joining me now, once again here in New York, somebody I have always enjoyed being around. He is the popular media professor at the New York University Stern School of Business. He addresses his students once a semester, and it's always a pleasure. He's also the co-founder of the annual Future of TV Forum that takes place in the Museum of Jewish Heritage here in New York, Battery Park City District. Pleasure to welcome back to this program after a very long while, Al Lieberman. Hi, Professor Al.
Hey, how are you, Simon? Delighted to be back. Wonderful. Wonderful first half hour, terrific show. I caught a bit of it, and happy to talk to you about the future of television. So let's get on with it. What would you like to know?
Well, let's address the question I posed at the top of the show. Where do you see TV going this next decade?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of things that are happening on television, but I think the very first thing that everyone who is involved with the industry or thinks about the industry or would like to know more about it has learned the phrase peak TV. And of course, what I'd like to tell you is that TV has not peaked. Whether it's 400 or even 500 new pre-recorded and scripted shows, we'll be seeing more. Now, they may not all last. Obviously, the networks are taking a very sharp pencil to those programs that don't seem to give them the ratings that they want. And that's just network TV and cable. The same thing is happening at the streamers, and we'll talk a bit about each of those pieces. The streamers, right down to Netflix, who used to leave everything, whether it was old and hackneyed or not terribly interesting to their audience, along with, of course, all of their new offerings. They would just leave them on the air to fill up space on their menu. These days, we see very definitely not only are they taking, again, a very sharp eye to look at programs that are not appealing to their audience, and of course, the great thing about the streaming people is that they have the demographics, they have the algorithms, they know exactly what is being watched and what is not, so they know if they've got what we would call, you know, cold, stale meat on their hands, and they immediately eliminate that, just as probably anybody who's anybody in the content distribution business has to be thinking about, which is how do we make room for new content? And that's the reason I mentioned that peak TV is not peaking, because now more than ever there are wonderful people from the highest end, the Shonda Rhimes and the Ryans of the world, who are getting paid huge amounts of money to generate shows literally as if they're coming out of the cookie shop, to young people who are trying their hands and are coming up with terrific first starters. While I don't mean to demean any of the geniuses that we have in our directorial portfolio, even someone like Woody Allen disappointed and, of course, fell out of love and out of the relationship, I believe, with Amazon after his first offering did not ring the bell for them. And so I think that that's the way that it is proceeding. I don't believe that unscripted or reality TV is going to become a greater percent of the offerings. I think there's too much wonderful material that's scripted, and it is, generally speaking, if we look at the most recent Golden Globes or even the Emmys, you're not seeing very much attribution for unscripted material. There is some, but not a great deal. People want to see the stuff that gives them a wonderful return on their entertainment time, if not necessarily budget, in terms of getting value for their time spent watching. And reality TV seems somehow to still appeal to a very select audience, and those people do come back again and again. I will simply tell you again, without being too politically incorrect, that I'm watching some of the shows that used to be part of Scripps and now been through a acquisition part of Discovery. Wonderful, David's Discovery Channel umbrella. And some of them are starting to look faded and not terribly happy, and maybe that's because they're not as thoroughly reality TV based as they could or should be. So what we're going to see for sure is a continuing expansion of quality material. Young people coming out of film schools will have chances the likes of which they've never had. The courses, without any shameless plug for our program or others like it, people are studying how to manage creative content and how to build shows and scripts. The confluence that I've talked about in the past, I think the word 15 years ago was convergence, when people were beginning to think about how TV was morphing into smaller and smaller screens, because of the conversions with the smartphone, the iPad, and the Mini. At this point, what we're looking at is the talent that's morphing. There was a time when, we don't want to go back too far, there was a time when movie stars and directors and other talent that love to be seen in front of or behind the camera and then on the big screen, today are absolutely recognizing, like a Reese Witherspoon or a Jennifer Aniston, who are doing extremely well on shows that are being presented on streaming television. Yeah. Streaming TV is the important descriptive.
Sort of to keep the flow going a little bit.
Sure.
One could make the case that this era of peak, what I've been calling plentiful TV for the last couple of years, may be morphing using your term, into two things this coming decade, starting next year. One is an era of mega programming services, which we've already started to see. Apple TV Plus, Disney Plus, BET Plus, coming next year in April, Peacock from NBC Universal and Comcast, coming from WarnerMedia, HBO Max in May. Who knows who else is going to get in? In addition, you have, thanks to smart TV sets and smart TV devices, all these new original services from the Fantasy Network to Topics, which just launched TOPIC, that also are going to do a lot of unscripted and scripted programming. And the second thing is maybe we are now at the start of the interactive TV era, where a year ago the thought might have been, will we ever get interactive TV in our lifetime? You now have Netflix and YouTube doing shows. You have Food Network Kitchen, which seems to be off to the races. You have Portal TV from Facebook, which allows you to do video chat on a television set. Where do you see both of these eras going? Is there room for everybody? Is there room for these mega services and room for interactivity in how we watch and use television?
You know, the easy answer is, of course, there is room for everybody. But the much harder rationale for it is that none of us, except those who have, and of course I'm making a slight anecdotal thrust about people with multitasking or cruising capabilities who can try to watch three or four programs in the same hour, most of us lock in on a program and we watch it, enjoy it, talk about it, and then we'll have missed the other 10 or 15 programs that are available at that time. What happens to them? If they're good, if they're great, then they have been seen by a reasonably sized audience. And, of course, I think the key word here to your excellent question is audience, people. Without people watching, without eyeballs, unfortunately, which is what they call us, viewers at the networks, the programs won't last. So at any given time, from the best research we have, people, individuals, don't get to see any more than 10% of the content or less that's available. And these are people who are, you know, not the nevers, right? We know about phrases like the people who are cutting the cord, and then they talk about nevers, who are people who, you know, in 1% who don't watch television. I don't know what they're doing, but they're not watching any of that. The rest of us are all intrigued. We're binging, and we are watching as much as we can. But the point, though, to your question is, if you haven't seen it on network television, or you haven't seen it on cable, or you haven't seen it on pay TV, there's a good chance it will be picked up by one of these, what, 5, 6, 7? You know, we stop counting at a certain point. So everybody will have an opportunity. What the net of it all is that while the people at the content producing and content distributing end are pushing it out, the consumers are loving the quality that's out there. I hear from people who are not even consider themselves to be maestros of television viewing who will say, now when I do watch some programs on TV that is obviously supported by advertising, everything has gotten better. The programming has gotten better, and the TV ads are getting better. I would say to you, if you'd like to hear about a projection, I would absolutely tell you that in the years to come, when you've got more than the 5 or 6 or even 7 giants, the monopolies that we would have called them back then, but now they've got competition who are competing for your time and now your budget, because streaming is not free, even though Disney may have given away a year's worth with Verizon, they're going to charge you money. And so when you stop and think about what you're going to pay, you'll make some selections. But the point is that the folks who are out there are saying, we're not going to let Disney have this world all to themselves. They may have a huge leap ahead because of all of the content that they have, but we're producing original content, and we're producing content that people like and enjoy and talk about. And of course, best of all, I know you're going to I heard your comment about the Golden Globes nomination, and I think that with a fast and quick survey, it doesn't take much imagination to see that Netflix has gotten quite a few nominations for their offerings.
As a matter of fact, Professor Rao, let me tell you.
Tell me.
Netflix was number one in terms of TV nominations, 17. HBO, by the way, had 15. And then you had Hulu and Amazon tied for third with 5. But here's the interesting thing. Netflix also received 17 film nominations, including in the category of Best Dramatic Movie, not one, not two, but three of their original films, mostly seen on Netflix, not in theaters. The Irishman, The Two Popes, and Marriage Story all were nominated for that that category, which is, I think, bringing up the speculation that maybe this coming year is the year, 2020, that Netflix may win Best Picture. Which some people thought, they would have won this year for Roma and for whatever the actor did.
And the nominations, from my perspective, but that's, you know, the opinion of one, are well-deserved because they have really kind of kept their nose to the grindstone and have made sure that the products, the content that's coming out is excellent. And what's important, because we who come from the world of marketing and advertising recognize that for a long time there was no need for people like Netflix to even advertise their content. It was back to the old days of the movie theater mentality, which is we will make it and they will come. Not when you have seven competitors in the streaming wars, and so now you're starting to see really remarkable, intelligent, and creative marketing and advertising to let you know what's on and why it's worthwhile for you to stop and see it.
On the other hand, though, getting back to interactivity, you think about the fact that now you have a situation like a Banner Snatch Black Mirror episode or You versus Wild, where you can dictate using not only your remote control, but thanks to artificial intelligence voice features like Google Assistant, Siri, Alexa, powered into your television, smart set or smart device, that you can control what you do with your voice. If you have Food Network Kitchen for $6 a month now, you can participate live in cooking classes every week, up to 40 a week now. Started at 20, now it's doubled. You can order products, whether it's groceries, kitchen utensils, ingredients, whether it's salt, pepper, nutmeg, you know, anchovies, and have Amazon deliver it to you same day or next day. And you can call up recipes from beef stroganoff to French toast from a library of 80,000 multimedia, presented multimedia fashion step by step at any time. And if you have, as I said, Portal, which just started about a month ago from Facebook, you can, with a camera attached to your television set, do video chat and maybe other things too. So going back to my other question here, I mean, how interactive are we going to get? Are we going to use TV to order a variety of products? Are we going to see retailers and advertisers from restaurants to the likes of a eHarmony use the set in a way? Are we going to use the set to connect with our doctors, our teachers, et cetera, as well as the ability to dictate how we watch a program?
Yeah, I think that we're looking again at something that has been percolating for years, right? We both know that interactivity is not a Johnny-come-lately, but in fact has been looked at and processed and presented and reviewed for some years now. One of the big issues is the separation, or I should say the semantic difference between addressability and interactivity. And to some degree, probably they're much the same. Addressability would be, you know, a part of that interactivity, which is where, you get to raise questions on television, to participate in politics. And in many respects, it is, if you can allow the phrase, you know, a deja vu all over again, it is coming back to the general store or the time, the town hall meeting. The area that you're talking about is also one. I go back to the early days when Condé Nast, a magazine empire, began to have their people working on making their magazines not just two-dimensional but three-dimensional. And the fact that you could open one of their magazines, particularly Wired, but you know, they were on the forefront of I wouldn't even call it AI at that point. It was just simply being able to bring to life a print ad, which suddenly began to show you the car that had been simply flat on a four-color page and now would become alive while you were looking at that page on your screen and see the TV commercial or the video. Let's call it a video because it might not even be a commercial made for broadcast or advertising-supported television. And you now could clearly see an auto of your possible choice because they knew their readers pretty well. And all you needed to do was by pressing your remote could actually see it in a different color, could learn about some of its benefits, might even be told about the showroom nearby and what the latest leasing prices are. So I think it had begun some years ago. What's happened now is that everybody's jumped on the bandwagon, and so no longer is it just the necessarily huge and large media players, but it's the corner shop, it's the pizza parlor, it's the StubHub service, which is certainly not a monolith, but can quickly, instead of your having to go down to the box office or stand online at TKTS on Broadway, which is still always great fun if you want to do something immediate, but if you can plan ahead, not more than a day or two, you know, you can get all of that taken care of with a thumbnail on your receiver and go forward and actually be able to become a couch potato. That's the bad news. The good news is that all of this represents what we expect to see very soon when all the details and the dollar signs come in on Christmas 2019, even though it seems that people are very concerned about it being a shorter holiday than ever between Thanksgiving and Christmas. I don't count the days necessarily. It's all one great big season with lots of people rushing around commercializing the holiday and buying gifts. But, you know, I'm going to project that anywhere from, let me get crazy, between 40 and 50% of the people who are out buying gifts today are doing it at least in part, if not all, online and therefore through some form of addressable features.
It'd be interesting to see, by the way, if they break out this year, somebody breaks out how much of the purchases were done on smart TV sets or smart devices.
Yeah.
By the way, Mobile by 3, one of our regular chat room folks, is in our chat room, so if you have a question or comment, put in. Another person also in our chat room as well. If you have a question or comment, put it in or use our number, 646-652-2906. Professor Rock, can you stay around for another like 10, 15 minutes?
I'm sorry?
Can you stay with us for like another 10, 15 minutes?
Sure. Certainly another 10. I'm here.
Okay, you got it. Because I want to do is I want to get to the Golden Globe nominations and also our classroom question, and then we'll get you back on for like another 5 or 10 minutes to respond.
Sure.
All right, great. Professor Al Lieberman from NYU Stern School of Business, who can stay with us. So we're going to go a little over time than we normally do with our hour. We're going to go like an hour 10, hour 15. Before we get to the Golden Globe TV nominations that were announced early this morning, let's go to our classroom trivia question of the week. And this week, our prize, brand new question, brand new prize. The 2020 American Express Small Appointment Book. That's right. American Express always does a great job with their appointment books. I have them at home, and we have a 2021 for you if you can answer this question. One of the most popular TV shows in the 1970s was the police drama The Streets of San Francisco, starring Carl Weldon and Michael Douglas. And in the 1950s, one of the longest-running shows was also a police drama set in San Francisco. Name it. That's our question. Name the 1950s long-running police drama set in San Francisco. If you know the answer, email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. That's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Make sure you enclose your name and your email address so that if you, or I should say your mailing address, so that if you win, we'll get the prize out to you. If you've already won, let somebody else win. We have a rule, only one winning situation to a customer. So if you've done this before, let somebody else win. Again, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. We'll try to bring the question back before we leave you today. If not, post it tomorrow morning on Facebook and on Twitter at UBCSimonTWBT. That's the UBCSimonTWBT. Remember, in order to win, be in, play in, and all the very best. And now let's recap the Golden Globe television nominations that were announced earlier today. Don't forget the Golden Globes take place on January 5th at 8 p.m. to Eastern Time, 5 Pacific on NBC. First of all, let's go to the program categories. For Best Comedy, the nominees are Barry on HBO, Fleabag on Amazon, The Kominsky Method on Netflix, The Wallace Smith Maisel, also on Amazon, and, this is a nice surprise, The Politician, Ryan Murphy's first Netflix program. For Best Drama, the nominees, Big Little Lies on HBO, The Crown on Netflix, Killing Eve on BBC America, The Morning Show, Apple TV's first nomination, and Succession on HBO. If you didn't hear the news note, Jesse Armstrong, the creator and executive producer of the series, now has a new program development deal, 3 years with HBO for that. And for Best Miniseries or Movie, nominees are Catch-22 on Hulu. That's the miniseries that was snubbed by the Emmy Awards early this year. HBO's Chernobyl, FX's Foxy Vernon, The Loudest Voice on Showtime, and And one of them, my notes are a little bit scratched right now. I'll try to get it a little bit later on. But that's the series of movies. All right. For Best Comedy Actor, the nominees are Michael Douglas for The Kominsky Method, Bill Hader for Barry, Ben Platt, the former star of Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway for The Politician. Also, Paul Rudd for Living With Yourself, the prize nominee on Netflix, and Rami Youssef for Rami on Hulu. Best Comedy Actor is Christina Applegate for Dead to Me on Showtime. Netflix. Richard Brosnahan for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Kristen Dunst from Becoming a Guy in Central Florida, a big sleeper hit early this fall on Showtime. Natasha Lyonne for Russian Doll. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge, the Emmy winner for Fleabag. In the drama acting category, the best actor nominees are Brian Cox for Succession, Kit Harington for Game of Thrones, the only nomination that series received in its final season, Robbie Malek for Mr. Robot, on last night's final season on USA, also Thomas Mercedes, and Billy Porter for, of course, Pose on FX. And best drama actress, Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon, separate nominations for the morning show. Olivia Colman for the current season of The Crown, as well as Josie Comer for Killing Eve on BBC America, and Nicole Kidman for Big Little Lies. In the miniseries acting categories, nominees are Russell Crowe for playing Roger Ailes in The Loudest Voice, Jared Harris for Chernobyl, Sam Rockwell for Foxy Vernon, Chris Abbott for Catch-22, and Sarah Baxter Cohen for The Spy on Netflix. Miniseries actress, Joey King, nice surprise, one of the big ones for The Act on Amazon. Caitlin Dever for Unbelievable on, Unbelievable was the other miniseries nominee for miniseries of the program. Merritt Weisz for Unbelievable, two acting nominations for miniseries actress for that show on Netflix. Helen Mirren for Captain the Great on HBO, and Michelle Williams playing Gwen Vernon in Foxy Vernon. The Best Supporting Actor, which covers everything, comedy, drama, made-for-TV movie, and miniseries. The nominees are Al Arkin for The Kominsky Method, Kieran Culkin for Succession, Andrew Scott for Fleabag, Stellan Skarsgård for Chernobyl, and Henry Winkler for Barry. And finally, for Best Supporting Actress, nominees are Patricia Arquette for The Act, Meryl Streep, Big Little Lies, Emily Wilson for Chernobyl, Helen Mirren Carter for The Crown, and finally, Toni Collette for Unbelievable. And that is the Golden Globe nominations for TV for 2020. Again, Golden Globes will be on live from Hollywood January 5th, 2020, 8-11 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on NBC. Two other things you should know about, a couple, three other things you ought to know about the Golden Globes early action. For the first time maybe ever, not one broadcast network program or actor was nominated. Also, not one made-for-TV movie program or actor was nominated. And finally, it was interesting to note that while Catch-22 got nominations and was snubbed by the Emmys, When They See Us, one of the major and the performance of Gerald Jerome as Best Actor, which won the Emmy back in September, that was not nominated. We're back now with Al Lieberman, professor of media at NYU Stern School of Business. What are your thoughts, any early thoughts you have about the Golden Globes?
Yeah, I think that it's a terribly exciting time for all of the folks in the streaming world to have come to the realization that they're making content that the industry appreciates. It's simple as that. There have been lots of contenders who have said, you know, they're really not in the business. They're on the outskirts. All they've ever done has been to pick up already completed material from the networks, from the cable companies, from the studios, material that's been pushed out of the theaters. And that was their pickup, which is really what the early days of AMC cable and even the earlier days of HBO, which was all what we called, instead of OPM, other people's money, it was OPC, other people's content. And today it is a wonderful demonstration of how well new talent and even existing talent has been appreciated by these new streamers. When I say new, in contrast with, you know, the TV networks that are around for so long. And by the way, I want to make a comment that's always important because there are rumors to the contrary that television is dead and cable is going away, and none of that's true. What it is, as I said earlier, is that they're just now limitless options for the consumer. I think that it is very hard for someone like me to comment on snubs, because I think that so many wonderful, wonderful talents and writers, directors, actors and actresses have been nominated and are being recognized, and more importantly, are being given not even new lives, but second acts or third acts, moving them from the screen. I haven't seen Jennifer Aniston on a TV or movie in the mainstream, but of late I've seen her at least twice on shows, even before her talk show with Reese, on movies, one with Adam Sandler out of Netflix. And she does a formidable job, and it's wonderful for her to have this kind of palette to work with. The big snub for me, only because I've been fond of him from the very first time I saw Robert De Niro in Godfather and then Taxi and then Raging Bull, that he was not recognized. And I think perhaps it is because he's so visible these days that you almost don't know, perhaps, the folks who create the nominations don't know where to give him his next award, whereas people like Al Pacino and, of course, Scorsese, who continue to amaze everyone but don't have the volume of activity that De Niro has. That's my best bet because, frankly, I haven't yet had the time to sit down and watch what some people are saying is too long and others are saying it's worth every bit of the 3 hours that you could watch The Irishman. The quality of the performances for all of those mentioned is superb, and you are living that era, and it is brilliantly brilliantly put together by a gentleman who knows his trade craft, Mr. Scorsese. Finally, only 1 or 2 years ago, I guess, was awarded as best director when he had deserved that award for years before. So, you know, we won't cry for Mr. De Niro all the way to the bank, but simply say that this is one of those that was missed. I'm happy to chat with you, but I think I've got students waiting outside my door, and this is their last week. So if you don't mind, I'm going to bid you a fond adieu and look forward to...
I do want to mention before you go that if you want more details about what the Stern School of Business does, Professor Allen included, here's where you go online, www.nyu.edu, that's www.nyu.edu, and then you can find Stern School of Business. It's a wonderful organization. The media students that Professor Al has are fantastic. It is always a joy to address them every semester, and I can't wait till 2020 before we do that. Professor Al, thanks for the extra time. Thanks for being here today and all your great
wonderful
thoughts. A very, very happy holiday season to you and your students, and all the best in 2020 and beyond.
Thanks again. Continued success. Bye-bye. It was a wonderful pleasure to be with you. Bye-bye, Adam.
Same here, Professor
Bye.
Al. Take care.
Simon.
Professor Al Lieberman from New York University Student School of Business joining us for this half hour and more from New York right here on Tomorrow Be Televised. Finally, one other thing, by the way, about the Golden Globes when it comes to television. It's time for the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to do what the Emmys have done, which is more than 5 nominations in a category. I'm sure there's some buzz about the fact that shows like HBO's Watchmen, performance by Regina King, Mr. Robot, which is having a fantastic final season, Zendaya's performance in Europa, that those shows, Euphoria, that those shows were not nominated, and others as well. And if the Golden Globes were to go from 5 nominations to maybe 8, 9, or 10, that might help things a little bit. Remember, we're in the era of plentiful TV now, and I think it's time for the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the organizers of the Golden Globes, to follow suit with the Emmys and do 8, 9, 10 nominations per category. Also, I think about doing a writing and directing, at least, in terms of the TV categories. That'd be great. And breaking up the movie and the made-for-TV movie series category as well, the miniseries and made-for-TV movie category as well. It's time. The made-for-TV movie people deserve their own category at last. Finally, last night was the Kennedy Center Honors in Washington, D.C., at, of course, the Kennedy Center. And one of the highlights, in a very special way, was one of the honorees, Sesame Street, with the cast members and producers on stage wearing yellow. They were doing so in honor of the person that brought Big Bird to life for decades, Carol Spinney. And not just Big Bird, but Oscar the Grouch, you know, the monster that loves trash. Carol Spinney passed away over the weekend. He was 85 years incredible. And until a few years ago, he was the heart, the soul, the voice, the embodiment of Big Bird and Oscar. And his Muppet magic was evident on every episode. It was wonderful to see last night that the people at Sesame Street he left behind felt the greatest about his work, that they honored him by wearing yellow. And I was happy to see that CBS This Morning also did a wonderful repeated an interview that Anthony Mason's co-host had done with the current Big Bird in honor of what Carol did, that Carol Spinney was a child at heart, and it was his ever-great love of kids. And being a child at heart, being young at heart, as the song would say, that had him be Big Bird for so many, many years. And I guess it's ironic that he passed away as Sesame Street this year is marking its 50th anniversary on television. Incidentally, another nice thing about the Kennedy Center Honors this year is that for the first time, CBS is going to present the program just shortly after its live production. I've been a critic of the fact that I thought that the Kennedy Center should have been carried live on CBS for years. In fact, one time we had George Stevens Jr., the producer, the longtime producer of the Kennedy Center Honors, on our program, and I raised that question with him. He was not big on the idea, and never really explained why, by the way. But no problem. Love the man anyway. He's just marvelous. Wonderful guest and wonderful talent, too. from all his work on television, documentaries, the dramas, and so on and so forth. But the good news is that for the first time that I know of, CBS will present the Kennedy Center honors rather than wait until Christmas, either shortly before or shortly after, and putting it on a time period that a lot of people will not watch, that the program this year will be on next Sunday night. That's December 15th, 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, or shortly after 60 Minutes and NFL Football. That's the Kennedy Center Honors with a special tribute to Sesame Street and to Big Bird, Carol Spinney. That's next Sunday night on CBS, 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time, or shortly after 60 Minutes and the National Football League games in your area. And, of course, for more details about the Kennedy Center Honors and last night's tribute to Carol Spinney, CBS.com, and also check out CBSNews.com for the segment that was done, the coverage was done on Spinney earlier today on CBS This Morning. Again, thank you to both of our guests for being with us and all of you for tuning us in on Tomorrow Be Televised. We don't know yet who we'll have on Friday, but we'll keep you posted throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. And next Monday on the program, we'll have Theo Anthony, one of the filmmakers behind the award-winning ESPN series 30 for 30. His latest installment is Subject to Review, coming on later this month, about how instant replay transformed the course of tennis. And our very good friend, the Pro-League Insider and brand new Next TV writer, Mark Berman, will join us. We'll get his thoughts about the best and worst of TV this year and where he sees the medium going in 2020 and in the next decade. That's all next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Televise. If you came in late on today's extended program or you want to catch up on episodes you missed from throughout this year, well, check out our homepage anytime you like, www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/televised. Remember, our podcasts are available 24/7 at iTunes, Apple TV, the Spreaker Podcast app, and at the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Go to iHeartRadio.com, put Tomorrow Be Televised in the search bar, click, and you're in. You'll also find collected podcasts on Media Village, the Media Leadership website. Incidentally, you can check out a column I wrote that's out on the first of two that will be out this week on coverage of last Wednesday's TV of Tomorrow show here in New York, held by our pre-Thanksgiving guest, Tracy Swedlow. And speaking of Tracy, I'm going to be on her Blog Talk Radio program on Wednesday afternoon. Looking forward to it. So if you can, check Tracy's show out, Radio ITBT, that's also on Blog Talk Radio. Check BTR for the time that that program is airing. And we'll keep you posted also, because it'll also be available on podcast. Remember, we love hearing from you. What do you think about our guests today and the things that are up to in the world of television? And what's your thoughts for where TV is going in 2020 and this decade to come? Love to hear from you. So email me, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. That's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to enclose your name and where you're emailing from. That's how we get involved in our classic trivia question of the week. We also have a feature that we do regularly called the Show to Know. If there's a TV show you like that doesn't get enough attention, well, let me know. We'll give it the attention and give you the credit for it. That's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. You also find me on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter at UBCSimonTWBT. That's UBCSimonTWBT. Remember, we always appreciate what you have to say about the world of television. Why? Because what you say matters now more than ever. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants, not through those of Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and iHeartRadio. Our production associate BTR is Candace Williams. Andy Toews, Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of BTR are Alan Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow Night Televised was brought to you today by Audible.com, an Amazon company. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. If you want a great holiday gift for yourself or others that you know, well, give them a trial run at Audible.com. And how do you do it? You go to audibletrial.com/televised. But Tomorrow Be Televised, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for your listening. Have a great rest of your week. We're back on Friday, regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Remember, whatever you're up to this week, please make it safe and make it great. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.